or things that people need to say. No? Okay. In some ways, the Western mystery tradition is very much a composite tradition. It really is a tradition with a history. Now, in a certain sense, yesterday, when we're tapping into the Egyptian strata, we're tapping into the beginnings of that tradition. But as we are here in Britain, looking, we're also deeply enmeshed wherever, you know, as this tradition has traveled across the Near East, it's picked up the Hebrew traditions of the Kabbalah. But it is also deeply embedded in this land and this set of traditions, which are about the kind of collective kind of experience of people who have lived here for thousands of years. And it doesn't just involve Welsh or Arthurian tradition. There's also great stuff, the stuff that needs looking at around English tradition, which is something we will get onto at a later point in some ways. But what we've been looking at today in relationship to this particular path, that is kind of a breakthrough path, a path of waking up, a path of bringing in a new kind of quality, a quality of awakeness. And as part of that, we look at the being with some of the deep collective traditions that come out of Britain. And in particular, we're looking in the shape that we're using, when we look at St. Illtyd, when we look at the Castle of the Mysteries, when we look at the Arthurian tradition, we're also looking at the roots of that in Welsh tradition. What happened in the meditation as we follow the meditation, we're working more intensely because we're working more directly with the body of light, we're in a more direct relationship with the inner environment. So St. Illtyd comes in much more kind of strongly, even just as we're walking in the woods. There's that sense of joining with the mind of St. Illtyd, who reminds us of the meditation of the villa of St. Illtyd we did at the previous meeting, which is his castle of the mysteries, his villa of the mysteries. The castle of the mysteries has many different shapes. And Illtyd is one of these pivotal kind of figures that you find in the inner world, connected with the British mysteries, who is connected with connecting the ancient mysteries of the land with Celtic Christianity, with the figure of Arthur in particular. He's a nodal kind of figure, Romano-British figure. So he connects us both with a particular understanding of the British mysteries, but also with that at a particular time, at the Romano-Celtic kind of time. There's a lot we will go on to look at around this, but that Romano-British kind of strata, it's like a little moment of history in these islands, where there is great civilization, there is a synergy between the ancient Celtic traditions and the Roman traditions, and that to the benefit of both. And again, within that layer of tradition, there is that sense of the universality of Rome. And the localization of Celtic tradition. Now, both qualities are important, but both have their shadow sides. Obviously, universality can lead to uniformity and the suppression of minorities. However, the shadow of locality is the fear of the stranger. And we have this very strange verse that comes out of the Welsh triads. Three things cause the destruction of logres: the receiving of strangers, the freeing of prisoners, and the gift of the bald man. Now, the triads are among some of the earliest of Welsh material. They're like the Black Book of Carmarthen. I'll go on to talk about these things in a bit more detail this afternoon, really, but I want to sort of keep close to the material of the workshop. And in the afternoon, I'm going to talk us through a bit more detail the different levels, the different things that we're touching in. Much of the experience for some of you will have been very confusing, right? These odd phrases, odd words, doesn't matter. You just allow the odd words, allow the strangeness to impact you. I'll explain it after lunch. But we're taken into, as we move from St. Ecclestrid, as we enter Prydwen, more powerfully this time, seeing the layers of people, seeing what we're joining into as we enter Prydwen, as we enter into these layers of people who have been working with the deep energies of the land, the deep energies of the mysteries for generations. We're given a book that is full, that has images, ideas, that is in a sense a magical book that we can revisit, that we can envision, revisit, and see what presents itself to. It's like a little, it's a sort of, this is an idea called a commonplace book, where people would write in the things that were meaningful to them, that would be their particular, if you like, book of prayers, book of inspirations, books of things that remind them of things that are important. And the littlest little book is like a commonplace book of the British mysteries, gifted to us by St. Ecclestrid. And then as we follow the meditation into the up through the across the lake, up the mound, across the sword bridge, through the narrow opening, into the hall of the table, find the hall of the table differently now, not in medieval shape, but in a much older shape, where instead of the grail there is the cauldron worn by the breath of the nine maidens. There is the more ancient figure of Arthur holding the sword of light. And the sword of light has the same qualities as the scales that we inhabited yesterday in the Egyptian working. It's the energy of balance, the energy of illumination, the energy of freedom and liberation. And having inhabited this, having embodied this, we descend down into the room of Yesod, into the foundation of life, into the hall of Nimue. In a sense, into the place of the Lady of the Lake, the Lady who wields the sword, and at whose request the sword comes into action. And as we sit in that place, and as we contemplate that path ahead of us, we're with the sense of the awakening of sovereignty, the awakening of the sleeping Lord, and the bringing together of opposites. Now, one of the particular forms that arose for me as we were walking that path is a very, very ancient form that is found in a small verse in the tale of Culhwch and Olwen, which is one of the oldest of the Welsh tales, and it talks about how every May Eve, Cwaetheladd, who is the daughter of Clydd Llawerent, who is a form of the Romano-British god Nodens, the god of the abyss. And she is a daughter of light. She is and she's connected with the figure of Croiwi from the tale of Taliesin, who is the most beautiful girl in the world. So she is an incarnation of balance and beauty. And she is the child of the god of the abyss, who is the kind of, in a sense, the figure that we find in the art on the Tree of Life, and who is connected with the Nodens temple at Lydney in Gloucestershire. And and is connected really with the deep waters, with the sort of the place where deep life comes from. And in this particular myth pattern, Croywi, each May Eve, is fought over by Gwythrio and Gwynabnydd. Now these are the energies of summer and winter. These are the things that have to be brought into balance. And a judgment day at the end of the apocalypse time, Arthur will make a judgment between Gwythrio and Gwyn as to who gets to perceive and to be with Cryddeled. And again, this is a kind of a myth pattern of apocalypse and renewal. So judgment day is the apocalypse time, and it's the time of opposites finally resolving, when actually, if you like, the universe goes into a place of stillness. And of course, in reality, the only way for to be with Cryddeled is for the opposite, it's for Gwyn and Gwythrio to become one. So again, this is this path. We're using very different symbolism this time. Looking at a very different mystery structure, but it is the same process as we were looking at yesterday in the journey through the pyramid, in the journey to the light filled figure of Osiris. But now we're looking at it in the dialect of very ancient Brythonic tradition. And one of the key bits of the kind of the journey is the sense of crying out. I'll come back to this again after lunch, but the one of the things that we find in British tradition in particular is the search for things that are lost, the longing for something that's got lost, the search for the lost object, the search for the lost princess. And as part of that, there's a sort of, which we find particularly in the Merthin teachings, really, is this art of crying out. So we find with Merthin, the beginning of the Vita Merlini, Merthin is at the great battle of Adireth, where he is crying out against the slaughter, the destruction of the young. It drives him into the forest, drives him away from human beings. And then there is his crying out in the woods when winter comes. He's been okay through spring and summer, feeding on the life of the woods, and he has his wolf as a companion. But as winter comes, his wolf becomes old and is dying. There is no food, and he cries out, "Why is there winter?" And there's a whole continual process, really, in the Merthin teachings of asking questions, receiving answers, crying out again, pursuing the kind of search. And within that, the confrontation of paradox. Now, one of the key elements that happens in the Merthin teachings is he is bound to a stake in the city, so that he can't find an answer in the wood. He's brought back into the city through the image of Gwendolina, his wife, who is a form really of Cryddeled, and that image of beauty brings him back into the city and into human relationship. But when he's in relationship with the human relationship and feels the harshness, the imbalances of human life, he feels the desire to flee into the city. And he is through the will of his sister Ganida, who in a sense is his other self, in a certain sense almost his angel. He is bound to a stake in the center of the city. And what then happens is he is contained and held in between the opposites. His prophetic gift starts to manifest. He sees beneath the surface of things. He sees the He sees for one thing that his sister's having an affair and deceiving her husband. But he sees also that there are treasures hidden in places and in unexpected places. He's presented with a figure who, first of all, is shown to him as a woman, secondly as a man, and thirdly, and each time he has to predict what death the person will have. And this particular person, he says, first of all, you will die from falling from a height. Then, dressed as a woman, you will die by drowning. And the third time that's presented as a differently dressed man, you will die by hanging from a tree. And Ganida uses this as a way of convincing Rithak Hasban that he's an unreliable prophet. But in actual fact, what happens to this particular young man is as he's on a hunt, he is chasing a great stag. He goes up into a high place, he falls from the high place, his foot gets caught in a tree, and his head is drowned in a stream. What's being described there is the ancient threefold death. It's also one of the very clear images in literature of the hanged man card of the tarot. Now, this sense of being between opposites, seeing beneath the surface, then in the Merlin story disturbs everybody, so they decide to let him go, in which case he goes off into the wood again, and he, to a certain extent, lives happily in the wood again until he has until he realizes that Gwendolina, who he's previously set free, is about to get married. He sees in the stars a forking of the light of the planet Venus, which suggests to him that Gwendolina is about to get married. And so he goes overtly, decides he should congratulate her, but he gets upon a stag and brings all the life of the wood into the marriage, and he's intending, and Gwendolina has a new husband, he is intending to bless the marriage. And we have this powerful kind of mandala set up, really, with Merlin, who is the man of the woods, in polarity with the new lover, intending to bless Gwendolina, who is his Caerlyddydd. And all would have gone well, except the lover laughed at Merlin and disrespected him. And in which case he then seizes the rack of horns from the stag, flings it at the lover and kills him. And then tries to escape back into the woods, falls off, and is captured again. And in a way, this bit of the strange bit of the story, which again I'll talk a bit more about later on, really, one of its meanings is that you cannot prematurely resolve opposites. And if you do, something unexpected kind of happens that actually screws it all up. Because what happens as a result of him falling off the horse, he gets captured again, and he this time is held in the city and held, and then there's a whole other range of prophecies and things that happens around him, until the eventual kind of conclusion, really, which is the idea of building an observatory in the middle of the wood. Now, many places you might build an observatory to observe the stars, and you wouldn't normally choose the centre of a forest. But what this represents, the observatory in the midst of the wood, represents the bringing together of the opposites of the city and the forest. Now, these are images we see actually in the prophecies of Merlin. We see a great maiden who holds the city of London in one hand and the wood of Caledon in another. And the bringing together of these opposites, fully these opposites, where as we pursue this path, as we bring together Tiferet and Yesod, create a new structure within us and a new structure within the world. And as a result of that, and as a result of that new structure having been made, a whole new layer of healing and of possibility opens out. In the Merlin story, he is freed of his original madness by a new spring appearing that hasn't appeared before. Now, the whole thing about these ancient stories, really, is that they certainly help us with our own understanding of working with opposites, but they also key us into strata, if you like, within the collective unconscious. So as we look at the Merlin stories, we look at the Arthurian stories, we look at figures like Saint Sandiktid, we key into times and aspects of human experience. Just bear with me one second. My escapee cat has just walked in. So I'll be back in just a moment. I've just got to close the gate. Or Ali's going to close the gate. Right. Sorry about that. Anyway, what I was saying before that is these things key us into different aspects of the collective human experience. Now, for example, this, you know, Sedicted really connects us, and the Romano-British experience connects us with a particular flowering of civilization in these lands, and a particular conjunction. You see, we went that way. I don't know. Sorry, Ali's on a cat. It was a particular conjunction of ideas and creativity that relied not just on Roman tradition, but on ancient Brythonic tradition. So, for example, we find, I suppose, at its fullness in Bath, in the great temple of Sulis Minerva. Now, in a sense, that the figure of Sulis Minerva, who is both Roman and Celtic, who brings a sense of the universal goddess Minerva, who was Athena, together with the local Celtic deity of Sulis, who is the eye of the abyss, the spring coming, literally the hot water coming out of the ground, that brings healing. So when we tune into Saint Ichtid, we tune into that kind of strata. We have access to that, and we notice how that strata is active within the collective soul of the country and the world now. When we look at the much later medieval figures of the figure of Arthur and the Arthurian tradition, we get a sense of that kind of Norman French, that kind of development of England as a kingdom. When we look at the much earlier Welsh material, the figure which again is a sort of, I don't know, 10th, 11th, 12th century, but incorporating 5th and 6th century material. Then we're looking at the roots of a tradition. Later, we'll look at some of the English material. We'll look at things like Beowulf. We'll look at some of the poems and the kind of that have formed the English part of our composite kind of national soul. Now, all of these elements, really, the reason why should we do this, and why did Jung think we should do this, is because these are part of us. They give gifts to give us as we engage with them, but they're active not just in us. They're active in the national kind of psyche. You know, when I was a kid, in my Welsh class, there used to be a great banner. We were there by the Welsh teacher, which talked about the time of 1284. And the phrase was Bradwyriaeth 1284, betrayal 1284. Now, the betrayal of 1284 is Edward I's investiture of the first Prince of Wales. Now, for my Welsh teacher, and even for myself, really, when you contemplate that, that becomes really kind of present. And so that kind of consciousness, the betrayal, the oppression of the Welsh by Edward I, gets to be a living thing in the human consciousness. And can, if you get carried away with it, lead you to want to kill English people, as if they are Edward I. And certainly, you know, some of the kinds of Welsh political resistance movements have worked very strongly with that image. Of course, we see it much more powerfully and much more painfully in Northern Ireland, where with the Orange Lodges, with the kind of the Cromwellian destruction of Ireland, where these things live within us. So part of the whole process of being somebody who works with these opposites, who works with the Clipart, who works is to be able to work with these ancient images in their positive aspect, but also to bind their negative aspects. So this verse that says the deceiving of stranger, the contemplation of destruction, what causes the destruction of Logres? Well, the receiving of strange elements that overwhelm can be destructive, but also the refusal to receive strangers can be destructive. The freeing of a prisoner. If the prisoner goes off and kills everybody, that is a thing that causes destruction. The freeing of an unjustly imprisoned person is a great moment of liberation. And then we're with the gift of the bald man. Now, in Welsh tradition, there is only one figure called the bald man. This is Tegid the Bald, who is the husband of Ceridwen, father of Taliesin. Well, for father of Movran, really, but foster father in a certain sense of Taliesin by adoption. Now, the bald man is one of these kind of figures you get in tradition, who is a challenging figure. So the gift is a challenging gift. So the gift which can cause the destruction, which will cause destruction and disturbance, is something that brings about the end of the world and the beginning of the world. But the question is, what ends and what begins? So the egg that you are given in your hand, an egg is an interesting image. For an egg to work, it hatches, which means a world ends and a world begins. What hatches out of the egg? What do we free and what do we imprison? What do we receive and what do we refuse to receive? Are key and fundamental questions that the bards would have considered and continue to consider in depth. And the fundamental kind of practice in that sense, really, is how to stay on the path, how to stay working with the pull and pushes of these of the opposites as they present themselves to us. Now, I'm conscious that in the meditation a lot of these words will have been mysterious and you might just have been confused, but it doesn't matter about that. It doesn't matter if you're confused, that you will have got what you needed in that moment. As I said, after lunch I'm going to talk about the British Mysteries in a more linear kind of way. I'm going to go through it in a very right back from the beginning, right back as it develops through time, so there's a bit of, like, you have a bit of a structure, a bit of context to see how the, to see how these things, how these things happen. I mean, the problem, I mean, the Kabbalah is a much more easy thing to talk about. It's got a structure, it's got a tree of life, it's got a body of teaching, whereas the Welsh traditions in particular are told through story. They're told through story and poetry and non-linearity, which makes them a very good match, really, for the more linear aspects of the Kabbalah. But it is help. But if it, it is helpful, sometimes I think, to have a bit of a context to understand, well, what is this? What is this body of poetry? Where does it come from? What are its roots? And how can I find a really my relationship with it? So, we've just got a few minutes left, really, before we break for lunch. Just see if there's any thoughts or anything that anybody needs clarifying just before we stop and before we restart again.
I was just going to say, in talking about poetry, when we were doing the meditation, these sort of lines kind of came up and it came up for me. There was actually from Fern Hill by Dylan Thomas.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Though I sang in my chains like the sea.
Yes, that's it.
Time held me green and dying, though I sang in my chains like the sea.
Yeah.
And I guess that really links with that sense of the prisoner and in some ways.
No, totally does. Yeah. Yes,
as well, green and dying.
Oh, completely. I mean, Dylan, absolutely. The brilliance of Dylan Thomas, really, is he completely links into the heart of Welsh tradition. He doesn't express it in traditional terms, but you find these extraordinary kind of images that come right out of that kind of collective soul, Marcus. It's a really nice thing to have emerged, really. Yeah, lovely.
And we're all imprisoned within time and space, aren't we?
Yes.
By being incarnate at the moment.
Yes, we are, and I think, and that's right. And that whole image of the prisoner and the different layers of that and what that can mean is a really powerful contemplation in a way.
Picking up on the poetry,
yeah.
Theme, I was thinking. So with Prithaya and Anand. And so something about, in a way, these creed occurs at particular times,
yeah.
Which almost encapsulate a state of a nation at a time. So that particular poem, almost like being a magical text and a creed occur, and thinking, I'm thinking of the Wasteland or the Quartets,
yeah.
Being in a way, it's the creed occur of its own time.
Yes.
And then I was thinking of actually Tony Harrison's V. And he talks about the creed occur, and there's the antagonist says, so what's a creed occur, cunt? Can't you speak the language that your mum spoke? Go fuck yourself with creed occur. and actually Harrison talks about man v. woman, black v. white, NUM versus the coal board,
yeah.
Class D class, as bitter as before. So, and I was wondering, because these seem such important, I don't know, almost crystallizations of thought.
Yeah, totally.
That was quite recent, 1984, but now it seems a long time ago.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if there's kind of anything now which represents that. It might be a poem, or it might be something else at these times of, in a way, disarray or fragmentation of this particular cycle.
So, what comes to your mind if you think about that? If you think about that, what do you think about?
I mean, I'm wondering if it's a new form, even if it's music.
I think it's video games.
Go on. tell us a little more about that. That's a new thought to me. Go on.
Well, they are trying to capture some of these sorts of themes, I believe, and become more interactive in the sense that it's, you know, how it's not just making the character move along, you can actually change the character and cause the character to do different things.
I wonder if there's something with language. I don't know, I keep returning to language in a way, like the Fern Hill and... So there's, I suppose the visual is so, yeah. I suppose there's many things, but yeah, I was wondering if there's something with words.
Yeah. Maybe
words are redundant, I don't know, or meaningless now.
What, in a post-truth world, you mean? Where we can make words, you know, but just tell lies with words. This video games thing is really interesting because it seems to me to interpose another layer between us and an internal reality. And I think it's probably a valid, to, you know, like films about King Arthur and things. It's a valid attempt to key us into mythic strains, but I think ultimately it's a sort of externalization that doesn't help us, but it doesn't help these things really awaken within us.
No, I think it's really, really problematic, but I think that even in the problematic side of it, that wish of, I don't know what to call it, a sort of a spirit of light tries to find its way and push through. I don't know, really. I'm sort of just kind of saying things off the top of my head. But I don't like it that it's going that way, this sort of metaverse stuff, but that's the way things are going.
Yeah, I mean, I worry about stuff like that, but I don't know. I don't know enough about that world to be intelligently comment, to be honest. But my worry about it is that whole is the simulacrum effect, where you get a simulation of inner experience. And I mean, I certainly remember years ago, really, when I was quite into video games myself, how I stopped doing them, really, because they started to interfere with my capacity for inner contact, because the images would come right into my own inner world very, very powerfully, and it felt like they were sort of almost remapping my neural system, my perceptual inner system or something. So I stopped playing with them. I don't know, but I think what's interesting for Ernest, as we finish this morning, is that your question is interesting. I mean, I don't think we have an answer to it, but what is the cri de coeur of now? You know, and I think that there's, I think, because in a certain sense, and I'll talk again this afternoon a bit about this, one of the things that we are seeing at the moment, so I don't know about a particular poem or set of words about it, but one of the things that we are seeing is the resurgence of very old fragmentary kind of attitudes. And in particular, the whole business of the war in Ukraine and the way in which Russia has become a player again on the world stage in a way that it hasn't for quite a long time in our lives. And the fact that that is connected to the ancient idea of Holy Russia. And it was an interesting thing where we had Putin talking to some kids on Russian TV, where he quite self-consciously was talking about how he sees himself as being like Peter the Great, and talked about Peter the Great's long war with Sweden in order to regain the rightful Russian territory. And so that sense of very old images, very old aspects of the collective psyche rising up to kind of to reassert themselves. Now there's a very particularly in Russia, there's a man called Alexander Dugin, who describes himself as a philosopher magician, as a chaos magician, and who has been an advisor, as one of Putin's advisors. He has also been a teacher to the Russian general staff for about 10 years, and who has been quite influential in the re-emergence of new Russia, which, contrary to some people's ideas, is not about the reassertion of the Soviet Empire, but actually about the earlier Russia of Peter the Great, which is the Tsarist Holy Russian Empire. Dugin also has been an advisor to Steve Bannon, who was Trump's advisor. And so there's a whole kind of strata, if you like, of mythic strata arising out of much older senses of nations and empires that's active in the world today. And we find it ourselves, the whole Brexit idea and the idea of Great Britain, the idea that there's a great resurgence at the moment of young people, of young far-right groups in Britain. And much more sophisticated, not like Combat 18 or the thugs of the British National Party, but of groups that are relatively small, but much more kind of sophisticated. So there's a whole, one of the answers, if you like, or one of the issues, one of the reasons why it's important to be able to work with the collective soul, is that there is enormous fragmentation going on at the moment, an enormous kind of out of the insecurities of our current time. There's a desire to recreate old dysfunctional realities. You know, so what isn't being looked at? It aren't the times when cultures cooperated. We're not looking at the golden age of Spain, where Christians and Jews and Muslims created an enormous culture, or the beauty of Languedoc before the Albigensian Crusade, or indeed the brilliance of the Romano British society before the Romans retreated. We're looking at times where times of monocultures, where strong men were in control and running the world, and where there was uniformity and domination of the stranger. So in a certain sense, that's part of the kind of the archetypal landscape that kind of confronts us at the moment. And our ability, in a way, to understand the collective unconscious, which is one of Jung's great teachings, really, and where he really starts to get this to be just before the breakdown of the First World War, when he has this vision, his dream of Siegfried and the wounded Siegfried and the blood going right across the continent. And then later, really, in the Second World War, his image of the ancient war god Wotan, Germanic to riding out with a wild hunt. Now, this ability, in a sense, to be able to work with these ancient images, not just to perceive them, but also to kind of meet them on their own terms and to bring a different kind of quality into the collective experience, is a critical part of the mysteries, in a sense. Not in the sense of doing stuff to cause outer things to happen, but it's meeting the disturbed forms on their own level, bringing balance and light into those, and then trusting the deeper sense of the divine to dispose and what needs to happen. One of the ridiculous things that happened around Trump is loads of American witches cursed him. Continually cursed him, and I would say very unsuccessfully. You know, you just have to say that. You know, okay, he lost the election, but he narrowly lost an election, and he's still probably going to make another bid for presidency the next time round, because he's got enormous political support. So when we talk about working with these things, we're not talking about doing something to cause an outer event to happen in any one particular direction. It's more that we meet the unbalanced forms, and through our connection with light, our connection with the deeper sense of balance, we bind and bring a different kind of quality into these archetypal realms, and then we trust that will work out as it needs to. Anyway, that's a bit over our time, so we should stop now and have our lunch, and I'll go and chastise the cat who has escaped yet a bloody again, and try and get him to confess how he did it this time. For the rest of you, enjoy your lunches. I'll see you all at 1:30. Fern is leaving us at this point, I think. So say bye bye to Fern. So Fern, of course, we will be back together at the beginning of first weekend in September. So I look forward to seeing you then, Dean. Okay. Have a good nice lunch, everybody. And
thanks. That was really clarifying. Thank you very much. Enjoyed that.
Good. Excellent.
What time are we back in? Half past
one. Yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Okay.